LA has the largest jail system in the country.
You got people that have been in jail just like one time in their life, can't get nothing because of whatever mistake they made.
I stole some ground turkey because I wanted to feed my family. We was hungry.
Off the Block, stories tracing the path from city block to cell block and back. Find it now at kcrw.com or subscribe on iTunes.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food.
I was there once when they had cuttlefish that was absolutely jet black, so black that it like sucked the light out of the air because it'd been tinted with an emulsion of its own ink.
That's our favorite food critic, the one and only Jonathan Gold.
The restaurant we're going to is Shibumi, and it's different from any place you've ever been, probably. It looks bare, but it's not bare. Most of the tables in all of the long dining bar are made from a single 400-year-old cypress tree that was supposedly dragged out of a swamp.
That's impressive.
And a lot of the joinery are the kind of things you see in like greenhouses. I mean, just beautiful. There's a big sort of cloud-shaped window set into the front. There's no sign. That's as close as you're going to get.
So it's a statement about craft.
Definitely. The chef, David Schlosser, has had a background very different from any other chef I've ever heard of. As far as I know, he was the only non-Japanese ever to work at Urasawa. And before that with, you know, Chef Masa at Ginza Sushiko. And he, you know, staged at places like Noma. I mean, he's got a really great, deep, eclectic background.
And how does that express itself on the menu?
The dishes are sort of obsessively cared for in a way that we haven't seen a lot here. There are probably 50 restaurants like in Tokyo, but there are none at all in LA. And the style is, I guess, vaguely Kappa Ryori, which just means that it's seasonal. He's as involved with, say, aging his own misos. I mean, there's like the two-week white miso, and there's like a miso that he says won't be ready until next year. There's a lot of seasonal produce in there, and it even extends to the cocktails. The first time I was in, they were sort of macerating loquat seeds.
Loquat seeds.
Right. And it turns out that they have a really strong, pungent, bitter almond flavor, like, apricot seeds. And they took the fruit and made it into a kind of, I guess, beer or kombucha. And they mixed it with the alcohol in which the seeds were soaked. And it becomes something that really expresses the taste of loquat in a way that you'd never thought of before.
Wow. So are we making our own choices, or is this a place that you go to for a tasting menu?
Oddly enough, it's not an omakase place. Almost every restaurant that is like this would be, but his happens not to be. It's much less expensive than you would expect. The dishes are mostly between like $7 and $25, not so much. The best dish there, and this seems odd when I'm talking about a Japanese restaurant, is the cucumber. I mean, you never think of cucumbers, right? It's just a cucumber.
Well, I actually do, so I'm interested to hear what this is.
It's salted, hollowed out, stuffed with minced shiso leaf, and dried bonito. It's almost like a three-course meal, except it's just one tiny disc of cucumber.
I love that this is the marquee dish. Now, what about sushi-like items or fish-based things?
There are fewer fishy things on the menu than you might think there might be. There's always a sort of sashimi of sea bream from Japan, which is layered nicely with pickled ginger bud. There will almost always be monkfish that has been breaded in crisped rice and fried, like the fried chicken in a lot of Japanese restaurants. And the dish of salmon trout that has been hot smoked over cherry wood is really delicious.
It sounds like a place not to miss.
It's one of the best new restaurants to open in Los Angeles this year. when you're getting towards the end of the meal, you should get a grilled rice ball, though it's unlikely that the people behind the counter will let you forget to get the grilled rice ball. It comes in a sheet of crisp nori seaweed, and they instruct you to eat it like a taco. It's somehow refreshing.
In a restaurant like this, are the desserts as interesting as well?
They are, actually. There's only a couple of them, but they seem to cover the spectrums. One of them is an absolutely classic warabi mochi made out of roots that have been, you know, boiled and prepared. And they have like a very stretchy texture. A little toasted soy powder is sprinkled on top and you eat it with toothpicks. Absolutely classic dessert.
Wow, wonderful. That's Pulitzer Prize-winning food critic Jonathan Gold. We've been talking about Shibumi in downtown L.A. Text the words good food to 69866 to get more weekly restaurant recommendations. Next, we head to Pasadena to hear how one of my favorite bakers around town got started in the restaurant biz. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Santa Monica-based public radio station KCRW relies on the support of its listeners. One way to help is by donating your old car, truck, boat, or motorcycle. We'll pick up the vehicle from anywhere in the country, put your old ride to good use, and take advantage of a great tax write-off. Visit kcrw.com/cars.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. Do what you loved as a child. That was some early advice Christine Moore never forgot about pursuing a career which turned out to be baking. But Blondie's with spiced gumdrops, an early invention, may be the only sweet not found at the small empire of restaurants she's built in Pasadena. Her famous caramels and marshmallows, however, are the ubiquitous welcome at every one of her restaurant counters. And she has a new book out, Little Flower Baking.
I always loved to bake. I took some small classes here at UCLA Extension years ago that really inspired me. I had a wonderful teacher. Her name was Julie Nikovich. I'll never forget her. And she had talked about working in Paris. And she had told us how when they would make the French macaroons, they would put the parchment paper on some wet burlap sacks to release the macaroons. And she spoke so romantically about Paris that I dreamt about going. And I had been to Paris before, but I dreamt about the life of Paris through pastry. And I had a situation in my life that really changed the course of my life, and I lost my best friend in a car accident. And it woke me up to the power of now, that if I did not follow my dream and go to Paris, that I could die tomorrow. And so I sublet my apartment and was gone in a month. I had a credit card with very little money on it.
And you could and you could say one sentence in French.
Oh, I didn't speak French. Yeah, I said bonjour and je m'appelle Christine. Not knowing is sometimes the best thing in the world, because when you can hold on to these romantic notions of what it might be like, then you'll go. And I did go, and it was the best thing I ever did.
You spent a lot of time learning incredible technique and
peeling apples. I was welcomed into Gerard Mulot's kitchen in the sixth through a man that I met, Juan Sanchez, who was also an American. He was working at Le Bieu, a little wine shop on Rue de Seine. And he introduced me to Monsieur Mulot and asked if I could stage in his kitchen. And I peeled apples for a long time and got really good at it. And I watched everybody and everything in that kitchen. I was the only woman in the kitchen. This was, you know, 20 some years ago. And then I lined tart shells, and I learned quickly that the chocolate tart dough melted, and I had to work fast. And I got so good at lining tart shells. My thumbs were going up and down so fast and, you know, time on task. It really gave me a lot of time to think about my future and what I wanted to accomplish.
And when you came back, what was the next step for you? Did you immediately find a job in a kitchen?
Immediately. Immediately. And the man that I went to work for said, forget France. Just forget it. We're not in France anymore. And I thought, oh, okay, I can try, but it's in my blood. But I understand what you're saying. I understand the concept of that. And he was a wonderful, wonderful person to work for. And then I met David Wins. I went to dinner there with my mother when Le Du Cafés first opened in Hollywood. And I was so swept off my feet.
And it took you back to Paris in
a way.
It
took me right back. I was working the line the next day at my job, and I called him from the house phone, like in between prepping salads, and left a message at Le Du Cafés and said, I was there last night, and I met Michelle, and I didn't meet you, and I just want to tell you the food was so good, and I can't stop thinking about it, and if you ever need help in your kitchen, would you call me? And this is my home phone. You know, there was no cell phones then. And by the time I had gotten home from work that day, my mother was visiting, and she said, the chef from Le Du Cafés called and left a message. And I couldn't believe it and quickly started working for David.
Cut to you open your first place making candy, which was, I remember, something that you started to do when you took time off for maternity leave and you couldn't stay still at home.
Yes, I had great fortune working in wonderful kitchens in Los Angeles, and we work at a fevered pace, you know, fast, and we stand for 12, 14 hours a day. And I worked up until a week before I delivered my first child and went home with a new baby and could not sit still and could not just relax into motherhood and sitting on the couch and thinking about working and wanting to be in the kitchen and missing the kitchen and missing working on the line. I mean, there's a real adrenaline rush when you work on the line every night. And so I put her in the baby Bjorn and started making candy.
And the candy was your way in to your first restaurant, Little Flower.
Yes. I had been making the candy in Los Angeles for about 7 or 8 years and then opened the restaurant. I had lost the kitchen that I was working in. Some things in my personal life had shifted, and I needed to get back to work. And so Sumi Chang from Europane called me and said, baby, there's a little bakery that just closed. Go over there. And I went that night, and I left a note under the door and asked if I could please rent this space and started making candy and marshmallows again in that little kitchen. Can I tell you my favorite story, and I often brag about this? I met you years and years and years ago. I had brought some of my candies and my marshmallows, and you were so kind and so supportive of what I was doing. And this was 17 years ago. And at the time, I needed a kitchen to work in. And I was driving to Smart and Final and putting 200 pounds of sugar in my trunk and working out of a friend's kitchen in Hollywood. And then that opportunity closed. And it chokes me up a little bit when I tell you this, but you gave me the keys to your restaurant. And you let me work there at night. At 4 o'clock in the morning, I would drive down there with two little kids. You gave me the keys to your kingdom, which is how I feel about it. And I schlepped in my cream and my sugar, and you let me whip marshmallows for a long time in your dough mixer. And I would pack it all up and drive it home and package it all up. But you are a big reason why Little Flower is still there today, and I can never thank you enough.
Thank you.
The key, you gave me the key to your restaurant.
Yeah. Well, I knew, yeah. How can I ask you this next question? It's so mundane. Okay. Making candy is incredibly tough on equipment because you start with really hot sugar often, or you're whipping something and then you have to whip until it cools down. Yet you recommend never throwing out a broken mixer.
I learned the hard way. I made a cake at home yesterday on a new KitchenAid. It is the loudest, most obnoxious machine I've ever heard. The old mixers were beautiful. They were smooth. They were made well. The motors were quiet. And I believe that if you can find somebody to rebuild that motor and keep your original piece of equipment, that is the best thing to do.
It's true. And online, they have these incredible diagrams on how to pull the machines apart and put them back together.
One of the guys in my kitchen is a machinist now, you know, cutting marshmallows, and he has taken many pieces of equipment home and fixed them.
What I love about your recipes is that they're familiar with twists and they're super obtainable. It's trying to think about what book of our generation this book reminds me of. And it kind of reminded me of a combination of Paula Peck and Maida Heater.
Oh, wow. Maida Heater's one of my goddesses.
Because it's like there's...
She's very much like me. You know, she's not a trained baker and, you know, she's a home baker. She's a home cook and her recipes are accessible.
Yeah, very accessible. The language is very direct. You have a recipe for teff, pâte à sucre, which may seem kind of off the wall because it isn't like a super like grain focused cookbook. Why do you use teff in this recipe? And what is it? Maybe just start by describing what it is.
It's an ancient grain. I have an amazing pastry chef, Cecilia, that works with me, and she is so current. And she brings all this crazy stuff into the kitchen that is brilliant and educates all of us on now there's a huge gluten-free wave and, you know, first people couldn't eat eggs, and then they couldn't eat sugar, and then they couldn't eat gluten. And you see people's issues through food over the years when you've been in the business for a long time. And so that's one part of it. But the other part of it is there's so many beautiful untapped grains out there that can be incorporated, and we try and do a little bit of that.
And also, you've been on a bit of a buttermilk kick.
Yes.
You seem to be a devotee.
I'm old-fashioned, and I'm old.
Do you ever make the buttermilk in-house?
Yes, absolutely. We make it all the time. You know, how many times have we gone to the walk-in at 2 o'clock in the morning, 3 o'clock in the morning, only to find out you have no buttermilk? So you just take some lemon juice and take a little heavy cream and mix them together and make a little buttermilk and then use that.
And what do you use it for aside from biscuits?
We use it for panna cotta.
Okay, so describe this buttermilk panna cotta.
A little tart and creamy and sweet and cold and has all the elements of cold cooked cream with a little sour flavor. Delicious.
Yeah, it takes the edge of the richness off of it.
Mm-hmm.
I still have the original panna cotta recipe you shared with me a gazillion years ago.
Oh my gosh.
On an index card.
Oh my gosh. We have people that come into the restaurant and are visibly upset when we've run out of panna cotta in the case.
Okay, I have to ask you a technique question because I have an issue with meringue, with pies. I have a horrible meringue problem. Why do you put the sugar for your meringue in the oven to bake?
The warm sugar starts to cook the egg when you put it in the mixer. You know, when you're mixing egg whites and sugar, your goal is to get the sugar to dissolve. But when it's already warm and it's also having a dual purpose of cooking the egg and fluffing it, you're one step ahead. When you try this technique, we did it on stage in front of a whole bunch of people down at USC at the LA Times Festival of Books. It was magical, and you really get a beautiful, beautiful meringue out of that. So you get a nice shine to your meringue when you've heated your sugar, too.
It seems like it's a bit of an easier way than doing an Italian meringue where you're pouring a dangerous hot syrup.
Hot sugar syrup, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
The milk and honey cake.
Delicious.
First of all, describe it.
Well, when I worked a long time ago at Campanile for Nancy, we used to make penne gelata. And the thing that I learned about working for Nancy Silverton is you make everything in-house. You know, when we made Oreo cookies, we used a black cocoa powder. And you can make everything. And when we made the penne gelata, I used to have to stand over the stove for hours and cook down that cream. And you cannot take on any color. So you're constantly stirring. You're cooking out all the water in the cream, and you're making this delicious, naturally sweet base for your ice cream. Sometimes those experiences, when you have never had an experience like that before, they're very profound in the pastry kitchen. I remember feeling moved by the fact that we had to keep this cream going, not let it brown anywhere, And the outcome was so magnificent, this glossy, beautiful, white, frosted treat. I've never forgotten that. When I went to Cecilia and said, let's make this cake for my brother's birthday, and these are my thoughts. Instead of using evaporated milk, we're going to make our own. We're going to cook it slowly over the stove for 6 hours, and the outcome will be 100 times better than what comes out of a can. Sometimes the trouble is finding the stove space to be able to do that. It's a luxury. You know, everybody's got to get in there. We made this cream. We cooked it down. Cecilia worked tirelessly on the particular cake that would be able to absorb the liquid but not fall apart, not disintegrate. And she developed this beautiful cake, and we put the combination together and added salted caramel and fresh fruit, and then we chilled it. And it gives me goosebumps thinking about it. It is delicious.
It's sort of like your take on a tres leches cake in a way.
Absolutely.
Your restaurants have a huge inventory of pastries, huge, and cakes, both sweet and savory, and the book definitely reflects that abundance. But is there a recipe you think people might be reluctant to try, but that someone who is not a beginner anymore should push themselves to make?
The one thing that I only ever wanted for my cookbooks was to be accessible. Because if I can do it, anybody that comes into the restaurant really can do it too. I'm not super specialized. And we have given people a lot of confidence in cooking and baking and trying new items. I think that the milk and honey cake, if somebody, you know, backs it out a couple days and cooks their cream and makes their cake a couple days ahead, that the outcome is so incredible. I mean, it does have a lot of steps to it, but what you get in the end is so incredible. Baking takes time. You can't just pull this out. It's not like cooking a steak. You can't just grill it and you're ready. I mean, you really do have to prepare. You have to prepare your ingredients. You have to have some forethought about it. So, I mean, I would say the milk and honey cake, I think, is my favorite.
So once again, you've signed on to judge the pie contest. You've been with us since the very beginning. And of course, you've been part of some serious debate over the years. I don't think people really could possibly understand how heated it gets.
Oh, it's incredible.
What do you look for in a ribbon-winning pie?
I think the number one thing that comes to mind is a properly baked shell. I would say that the majority of the pies are underbaked, and people try very hard to impress with a lot of crazy combinations. And I mean, I want the most delicious apple pie, period. Simple and well done. Keep it in the oven longer. Really, really examine your undercrust and make sure that it's properly placed in the oven and that the bottom of your pie is properly cooked. So I say, just push yourself outside of your comfort level and leave it in the oven. Custards are different, but if you're doing a fruit pie or nut pies can be different too. You don't want to burn the nuts, but I tell my staff, bake like a French girl. Leave it in the oven.
Perfect advice. That's Christine Moore. She owns and operates Little Flower Candy Company, Lincoln, and her new restaurant, C'est La Vie. She's one of the judges in our pie contest this year, which is taking place on October 2nd at Royce Quad at UCLA. You can find a link to enter at kcrw.com/events. In a minute, Jessica Koslow, the owner of Squirrel, joins me and Christine in the studio. Don't turn that dial.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. KCRW relies on member support to help keep our programming fresh and authentic. Find out how you can donate at kcrw.com/join.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. There's a lot of talk about sustainability in the food world. Often it relates to ecology or organic produce or animal welfare. But there's beginning to be an important conversation about the sustainability of restaurants themselves and the people who work in them. Fundamental stuff like making enough money to buy good product and treat employees the way they should be treated, and then have enough money left over for the owner to thrive physically and emotionally. It's a very difficult task. much more so than those outside the business imagine. I've wanted to explore some of these issues for a while, so joining me this morning are two exceptional cooks, chefs, and restaurateurs, Christine Moore of Little Flower, Lincoln and C'est La Vie, and Jessica Coslow of Squirrel. Christine, how long have you been in business on your own?
I started Little Flower 17 years ago, and I opened the restaurant almost 10 years ago.
And you, Jessica?
Started Squirrel 5 years ago and opened the restaurant 4 years ago.
I hear rumors that there's expansion plans in the works.
Yes. I'm opening a restaurant on the west side of town next year, 2017, around March, April.
Could each of you describe the neighborhoods you're in?
Little Flower is in a beautiful neighborhood in Pasadena. Happens to be across the street from the freeway. But the community surrounding it is lovely, supportive community, and there's nothing else around. You know, it's not in Old Town. It's in a little section outside of Old Town. So it's been wonderful to feed that community. When I first went there, people said, "Are you kidding me? Why are you here?" And it's been such a wonderful evolution. I think that restaurateurs need to go where they can afford to cook. I have experienced that over and over and over again. That's my philosophy.
So when you opened Lincoln on Lincoln Avenue?
It was a rough part of town. I found an abandoned building. And I had lots of friends that went to the charter school there. And there was nothing up there. You couldn't buy a cup of coffee anywhere. And I would go up to Super King and go grocery shopping. And I saw a void and I saw a need in Pasadena. And for 3 years, people told me I was crazy. But I have a philosophy that if I want it, hopefully maybe someone else will want it. And I think that's proving to be true. That neighborhood needed to be honored with a sense of community, a place to go, a place to gather. And it was an abandoned building that the kids across the street were using for drugs. We turned it around and built a beautiful little spot.
And then C'est La Vie is in Montrose, another sort of tucked away community that doesn't have enough stuff.
Well, I'm old, Evan. I'm not interested in going downtown. I can't handle the traffic. I moved up to Altadena. I'm not young and hip like Jessica. I'm old and tired, and I want less traffic and a little more ease, a little more nature. And I learned a lot from building Lincoln. It was just such a difficult project. We decided to do a project that would be easier. Purchase a restaurant that's for sale and redesign it and rebrand it and open in 8 weeks.
And Jessica, what's interesting, I realized after I booked the two of you coming that this difference in generation and longevity in the business is really interesting because you're sort of at the beginning of this. When you opened Squirrel in Virgil Village adjacent to Silver Lake, it was just like, why would anybody go on that block?
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. I think we have a lot of similarities, even though maybe we also have differences. Squirrel is in, I always say it's in the backside of Silver Lake. It's really East Hollywood. It's on a street that people never thought about. It was always like a transitional area to get you from the freeway to Los Feliz or Silver Lake. When Squirrel went there and all of a sudden it was feeding Silver Lake, which is right next to it, it was a surprise that it was a success, even to me, because when I opened Squirrel in that location, it was just to make jam. My initial thought was, I don't really need anyone to come here. No one really knows what this is anyway. It's okay that I'm just hiding in here, squirreling away. And you said something about finding a place. It doesn't matter if it's off the beaten path. And a lot of times when it is off the beaten path, your rent is a little bit more reasonable. And it means the sustainability question that we're talking about here, which is you can put the money into the things that are important to you. Food costs, staff. That's the question for each chef, each restaurateur. What is important?
Where do you want to spend your money?
Yeah. The new place for us is also in an interesting location, which is off Barrington between Olympic and Pico, right where the new Expo line basically drops people off of Bundy. But it's on the cusp of Santa Monica, on the cusp of Venice. It's in Sawtelle, truthfully, and on the cusp of Brentwood. It's in a location where people will go. There is the train and there is a neighborhood around it.
what I find to be so interesting now that LA has all this infill and it's denser is all the little villages that make up LA. There's more of an idea of servicing that neighborhood.
It's so important. It's so like people, we're trying to recreate old Paris.
Right. So people can actually stay in their neighborhood and right. not have to
or
traverse
walk to the
whole city.
Walk off their wine on their way home and not get in cars. It's really important to service your neighborhood, your community, and build a sense of community.
I have to say that I'm in this strange place because having been in the business and not being in the business anymore, but being a person that is sort of still sort of attached to the community, so often when I go to a restaurant or I'm somewhere where there are chefs, somebody will just walk up to me and just say, remind me why we do this. What is there in your individual lives that is your support, that through line that has you keep going even when it's just really tough?
For me, what keeps it exciting is the continual evolution of the work. You know, our menu is always changing and evolving. And that's based on personal growth, I think. You know, the menu that was Squirrel 4 years ago is very much not the menu that is Squirrel now. That is what keeps me going in this, is figuring out the evolution of flavor for me and for what our restaurant does.
For you, Christine, as you pumped out more locations and your vocation evolved from hands-on cooking every day to more a focus on hospitality and the books and making sure that the whole group is paid and the paychecks go through?
I think my angle on the business is it's all about people. I mean, I love to listen to you because it's almost a luxury for me to think about a life like that. I have three kids and I have to, you know, make sure I don't taste too much wine in the afternoon for the new restaurant because I have to go do carpool. And my angle is different. You know, I love to bring people together, and I love to bring people together with simple food, fresh food, delicious food, and create a sense of community, and to do that with my staff too. We have very low turnover. We try super hard to take care of our people. The food is the binder. You know, it's the reason to, but once we're all together, there's so many layers between our conversations and the wine and the food. And I just really believe that I'm a humble servant. I was born that way.
Yeah,
I just am. If I were in prison, I would be like serving everybody in prison, or, you know, it's just my nature. It just so happens that I learned how to bake a long time ago, and, you know, all the good food at the restaurants are due to everybody else, but I just love to serve. And I tell my staff, you have to be a humble servant if you want to work here.
How hard is it to find people who are willing to serve and acknowledge that what they do is in the service of people who come through the door?
It's interesting. I do agree with you that the end goal is to also create a place that has a feeling of community. And that does start with your staff. It starts with them feeling like they're a part of something. I mean, their energy radiates in the space. To me, it's very important that whoever comes through that door is treated with the utmost respect, like they're a part of this community. Is it hard? It can be challenging at Squirrel because we do have so many people that come through the door every day. And there's a lot of questions. There's a lot of modifications. But that is something that is constantly on my mind.
I heard that at MAD, which is this conference that Rene Redzepi hosts in Copenhagen every year, I heard that he announced that he was going to be having a four-day week for his employees and was going to either have a gym on premises or...
I did go to MAD Yale this year. We worked out every morning. It was just Rene and myself, but he opened up the opportunity to work out to everyone who was there. And that is what he does at NoMa right now. He has an instructor that comes to his house every morning and he invites his entire staff to work out with him. And then they have breakfast together. The number of people that do come can be slim. And that's what we've done at Squirrel as well, is to offer a gym class that everyone can go to.
It's interesting. Hard. You can offer a lot of things, but what people take you up on is interesting. Yeah. We have a massage therapist come to the back deck of Little Flower, and some of these guys, I would have to say, no, really, it's good. Go for it. You know, it's okay. They're just going to rub your shoulders. And they'd say, no way, Christine. We're not doing that.
That's amazing. How often does that happen?
Once a week.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing.
But what struck me when I heard this was this idea of a four-day week. If you don't have a restaurant where the average check is in excess of $200, how hard is it to get to a place of sustainability with money?
You have to manage it well. You have to choose what you want to spend your money on. You know, we couldn't afford to shop at the farmer's market when we opened Little Flower. You know, now we can shift things around. We bought plastic bowls from Restaurant Depot because I couldn't handle breakage. Believe me, none of those plastic bowls broke, and I never had to replace the dishes. You have to do your math.
Yeah, I feel like I do a similar thing at Squirrel. Also, Jose Andres turns to me and goes, I would never do breakfast. It's a hard game. A lot of times, there's no alcohol in breakfast and lunch. Like, restaurants really survive and thrive based on alcohol sales. It means that a restaurant like ours that has breakfast and lunch has to do numbers.
I think there's just as much profit in coffee as there is in alcohol.
There can be.
I really
do. There can be. For us, then, if it is about the number of people that come in through your door, you have to make it craveable. You have to make it feel like a sense of community. At least for me, and it seems like for Christine as well, there has to be a soul present in the space to make it feel like a place that people really want to come to.
I think breakfast is super underserved everywhere. Everybody wants a hot breakfast.
Well, LA is a big breakfast town.
Yeah.
We like breakfast for dinner, too.
Yeah.
Jessica, you were self-financed because you started so tiny and you didn't have this intention of opening to the public. So that allowed you to self-finance.
Mm-hmm.
And you've been able to continue doing that.
Not with the new spot.
Do either of you have a business consultant or a sounding board, somebody that you can go to when your just mind is blown out with anxiety and worry, or you really feel like you need somebody outside your own head to give you some context?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of different points of anxiety in this industry. You know, one being fiscal, right? And I am fortunate to have a great accountant who also does John and Vinny and Joseph Centeno, and he's a stickler, and I love that he's on my side.
I have a mentor that I only go to discuss HR problems. I think that's the hardest.
I think I might turn to you to be my mentor for
I think HR. It's so great that we can have a conversation about that, because the one thing we need in this industry is to not feel like we're alone.
And LA can have a larger feeling of that just because of the sprawl, you know? Like, it's
but
been
the,
a long
the
time
great
since
thing
I've
about
seen
the
you.
LA restaurant scene, though, is we've all got each other's back.
It's true.
We really,
true.
Really care about each other.
This idea of making a choice as to whether or not you want to have a single restaurant where you're lashed to the stove and you're going to work from the minute you're there to the minute you leave, or whether or not you're going to have multiple locations. Is it part of the fiscal sustainability? Is it that you end up having people who need somewhere to rise to? Is it that you need another forum to develop other ideas?
Other ideas. I'm working on a new concept now. There's so many things that I want to do. For me, it's all about letting out all of that energy and all the ideas. It's so much fun. I feel so lucky to be able to do that. Every restaurant is a different concept and different food, opened at a different time, opened at a different age. And yes, you know, the great saying is you can't move up until someone can take your job. And that concept has really helped a lot of our staff members that want to move up in the industry. We want to constantly be learning.
Jessica?
I mean, I think that's all three. Fiscally, Squirrel is small. I want it to continue to be this hub of exploration of what food can be for breakfast and lunch. And therefore, I have the desire to do a dinner project. But I'm really curious about continuing not only to serve, you know, I am from Southern California. The new dinner restaurant will be very much a Southern Californian restaurant. But not only exploring an angle of food, but also an angle of ingredients. So we have a farm in Malibu, 2.5 acres, with a fermentation lab going on the farm. And the farm is specifically drought tolerant based on what our land can truly provide. Will all the ingredients be from the farm? No, but it really is an exploration of what kind of growth can happen that we don't see at the farmer's market. And those things will enter into the restaurant. And we have a lot of chefs that have been at Squirrel for a long time that have real keen interests in exploring not only new foods, their own skills, but also exploration in science. And so it is an exciting thing to be able to provide yourself with continual excitement in the world that we're working in, and also to do that for your staff.
I heard that one of the chefs at the MAD conference, Trevor Gulliver of St. John in London, talked about digital media in a way that many young people kind of wouldn't recognize. He said, don't do marketing and social media and you'll have a restaurant. Go and work quietly, even if that means working at McDonald's. The world is not TV. TV is not community. And it takes 5 years in order to have a good restaurant.
Oh, just gave me chills. That's beautiful.
That's great.
So it gave you chills. Now, Jessica, you come out of a digital media producing background.
Mm-hmm.
So did you see Squirrel as a brand from the beginning?
No, I mean, I had no idea. I was, you know.
But can I tell a story about when you came into Little Flower with your
germs?
She's sitting there with Tim having breakfast, and she comes in the back and comes in the office, and she's got everything. She's got her jams and her stickers and her postcards and her bag. And I said, who are you? You are unbelievable. This is incredible.
You're going to tear it up.
I'm going to shoot the moon. I was so impressed when I met her for the first time. And I wasn't wrong.
She was pretty much one of the first people that carried Squirrel.
I didn't even taste it. I didn't care. The jar and the screening on the jar. And Jessica herself, she was confident and she was excited and she was...
Yeah,
she had it going on.
Even though I came from digital, I also came from working as a pastry chef. So I kind of towed these lines between understanding that people are eating with their eyes and also working in the kitchens quietly before even social media even existed. And so I feel like there was a balance that had to be struck. After MAD, we went to Paris and we saw Bertrand and Tatiana, who have Septime and Le Servan, two of the best restaurants in Paris. They're a couple. France has a law where it's 5 weeks of mandatory vacation that is paid to all staff. And also, these two restaurants are closed 2 days a week. They're dinner restaurants. They are closed Saturday and Sunday, meaning that their staff works all 5 days together with them. But the price point is high, higher than what we can provide. And it was just so idyllic thinking about 5 weeks vacation, you know, healthcare benefits, and a team that works every day together.
Yeah, then you have to pay 70% in taxes in France. I mean, somebody has to fund that. It's idyllic, but...
Then conversely, no restaurant is just a restaurant. I mean, you have the restaurant, you have delivery and to-go, you have catering, usually on the site. You have all these additional streams of income so that you can maximize that space.
That's true.
You have to have layers in your business. In the summer, nobody's eating pastries because they're all putting bathing suits on. You're killing it on the salads, or, you know, there's so many layers. You've got your jam business. I've got the caramels. I mean, in the winter, the caramels pay for the staff to make them in the summer because nobody's buying caramels in the summer and we're not shipping them. So the more layers you have to your business, the more you can survive those different times.
Also, the wave of attention that comes when you open something new, particularly in this age of social media, is that something, Jessica, that you worried about? Like, how long will it last?
Yeah. You know, with the Eater, hot new restaurants, you know, that happens every season or every other season. So twice a year, it seems like there's this new interest in, like, going to the next new hot place. There is that question of how do you keep something that has been around for a long time fresh and interesting? And part of it can be the layer of community, part of it can be the layer of exploration, and part of it is also, like, what are you doing outside of the industry? How do you keep that restaurant alive with your other interests? You know, you think about Chez Panisse, and Alice Waters has become a really active participant in Edible Schoolyard, which she founded. I mean, her mission is so strong, and it helps to, like, for people to understand her perspective in the world. I don't know. I think as I've gotten older, I've I've realized that as long as I can stay focused on the goal and what I'm trying to build, I'll be okay.
I've been talking with Christine Moore of Little Flower, Lincoln, and C'est La Vie, and Jessica Coslow of Squirrel. Next, Jessica sticks around to discuss everything she wants to eat. Stay with.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Listen to the Rhythm Planet podcast to explore music from all corners of the globe, Brazilian, European, African, and tropical Latin. Rhythm Planet is a state of mind. You can listen at kcrw.com/rhythmplanet or on KCRW's app.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. Toast with a slather of ricotta and a pool of jam. The most delicious things in bowls. Yes, we're talking to Jessica Coslow of Squirrel. The Force of Nature created a restaurant that exemplifies why people say that some of the most exciting eating is happening here. But Jessica is, of course, more than toast with jam or a salad with crunchy rice. Her new cookbook, Everything I Want to Eat, shows why. Were you worried about asking home cooks to make every part of each dish?
Yes, absolutely. To do this cookbook justice meant showing all the steps for all of the components that are in each dish. When you look at the recipe, it can feel a little otolenghi, plenty. There's a lot of ingredients. There's a lot of steps. But what I tried to do in the recipes were offer modifications. So let's say you don't want to spend the time to preserve lemons. At least you know how. But here's what you can do. You can go buy those. Or if you don't want to make ricotta, here's how to do it, but you can buy it.
I also think the book is a really interesting examination of what it is that makes a lot of Los Angeles food so bright with flavor and rich often, but also healthy. So if you were going to say to somebody, this little recipe or sub-recipe is a way to add something to a lot of the things you eat every day at home, what would that be, that little sub-recipe?
The thing is, there's so many different. For example, there's avocado toast, beautiful avocados in California. And yet we put on the toast a base of a garlic creme fraiche. And that garlic creme fraiche really adds a little bit of tang and heat to the avocados. It makes that toast dish something that I can't take off the menu. There's also lacto-fermented hot sauce, which we ferment jalapenos, and it finds its way into the base of crispy rice salad, into the sorrel rice bowl. We serve it as a side with hash. It can really be that little heat for any moment that you'd like.
Speaking of toast, can you describe the baguette toasts, what they look like? The picture in the book is really incredible.
Hugh Atchison calls this the big crouton. But basically, we take a baguette and we cut it from tip to tip, so lengthwise. It's a longer than a ruler piece of baguette. And we like to serve that with the chickpea dish that is in the book. And we also turn that into an appetizer that we put really delicately cooked squid, tomatoes, and aioli on.
So describe the chickpea dish.
The chickpeas are the cover crop from Robin Koda, who grows all of our brown rice. Those chickpeas are stewed really slowly and then with a lot of kind of Middle Eastern spices. And then they're mounted with aioli at the end, which humorously is the same aioli that we use for the big crouton. It has two poached eggs, some really finely chiffonaded Swiss chard, and then the toast on top. And that's breakfast.
Going back to the ricotta toast just for a second, you say that it's the blintz of the Catella Deli post-Sunday school of your youth in toast form. Is this relationship to Jewish food and culture going to be more apparent in your next restaurant project?
It is. the next restaurant project has a lot to do, I would say, with Jewish diaspora. So for me, there's been a migration of my family out of Israel into Eastern Europe, Hungary and Germany. And so you'll find this kind of wavering between, I would say, Middle Eastern and Eastern European coming through. So maybe a bagel with nigella seeds or everything bagels, like a za'atar bagel, things like that.
I have to say that the relationship to all the people who make all the things that you use is very beautifully evoked in the book.
Thank you. We have a lettuce farmer named Shu, and Shu is in San Ynez. While his lettuce and his corn are extraordinary, he also has tomatoes that come right at that moment of just sheer sweetness. And so at that point, we make a charred tomato soup with croutons and mint. Pretty simple, classic recipe that can be made cold or warm. We also have a recipe in here for a tomato party, which is a tomato salad with kind of a feta buttermilk schmear dressing on the bottom. In that way, we use the tomatoes completely fresh, just cut, but we'll take the stems to make a tomato oil. We'll take some of the tomatoes and turn that into a paste, and we can and have taken that paste further to dehydrate fully and turn that into powder. I guess the thing is, here's tomatoes in all of its forms. It's cooked as a soup. It's eaten fresh. It's turned into a paste. The stems are made into oil. The paste is turned into powder.
Give us some jam tips.
The jam section's pretty lovely. It starts with Michael Krikorian, whose partner is Nancy Silverton, giving us a story about the shady lady rise to stardom. He wrote a very funny story on how I came to be. And then the jam recipes themselves, I know that there will be a book that's just specific to jam and preservation in general, but I wanted to choose ones that kind of gave you an idea of the season, as well as were easy enough to start with. There's two recipes that would be great for now. One is a tomato and coriander jam. It's a little savory. It has salt in it. And so we end up using this one at the restaurant with a grilled cheese. It showcases what you can do maybe on more of a savory side, serve it with cheese. And then we have an apple butter recipe in here. We tend to use a slow food arc of taste variety called Gravenstein that's up in Sebastopol. It provides the silkiest, pinkest apple butter you've ever had, but it doesn't mean you can't use any variety that you have around. It just gives you the steps for how to make an apple butter the way that we do.
That's Jessica Coslow of Squirrel. Her new cookbook is Everything I Want to Eat. The book is worth buying alone for that essay called Shady Lady. We close out the show this week at the Santa Monica Farmers Market with one of the farmers who Jessica loves to work with. Take it away, Laura.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. You know, in a world of nutritious greens here at the farmers market, farmers markets everywhere, I think a lot of people tend to overlook the deliciousness and nutritional value of lettuce. And one of the people that does an amazing job of growing lettuce is Shu and Debbie Takakawa from The Garden Of, which is an organic farm up in Los Olivos. And I first saw your stand, Shu, at the Hollywood Farmers Market. I literally stopped in my tracks and said, what am I looking at right now? It was so beautifully laid out. You're now at the Wednesday Santa Monica Market. You're bringing your lettuce. You bring your corn. You bring a few other things. Tell us what it is about your lettuce that makes it so incredibly delicious.
The reason I can grow good lettuce in hot Santa Ynez, because of that place, nighttime temperature cool off. Then daytime is high. But as long as the nighttime temperature is low, I can grow lettuce. And also, we don't have much fog or overcast. That actually benefit because I have a strong sunlight. And that makes lettuce grow from the inside out, make a good tight heart.
Okay, and now the one, too, that's so popular now is that little gem. So tell us when you found the little gem.
And when I first started my own business, I grew little gem. That was so disastrous. I took to the market. why should I pay the same price this little lettuce? Mm-hmm. And so people just totally didn't got that. So I just quit. And then the consumer, actually the chef, is kind of after that little gem. Mm-hmm. And so I went to back then in UK because the little gem is very popular. And so I went in UK and found a few nice variety and sent to me the seed. And then I just started growing it.
How did you find the little gem variety in the UK?
Oh, I don't know how I did it without the internet. I just totally, I don't know. I just totally don't remember anymore, but I did.
Nobody remembers anything before the internet.
Correct. Now, also, I went to also New Zealand and also the Australia, too. Some seed came from.
So what's the best way to prepare a little gem to eat?
That is a very versatile lettuce. Because you can take apart, then you can use as a whole head, or you can shred it, then put into the taco, be very crunchy. Or you can cut slice lengthwise, or half, and grill it, or quarter. Then you can use as a, like a finger food, dip it and eat. And so that's very, very versatile. Yeah.
And you also grow the beautiful butter lettuce, and then your romaine is amazing.
Romaine, of course, is very popular among the chef because they use for Caesar salad. Because of that, they can use whole leaves. They can play with it because a big romaine, they have to chop it. And but this one is so crunchy and leaves are small enough for them to stack up and make a nice fancy.
So is it a matter of when you pick it or is that all the bigger that it gets?
I always grow to a max of their growth mm-hmm. because if you pick earlier, there's no heart. That's where the crunch is.
Now you plant so many, are you going to be able to grow these all year round?
Yes, I can grow that all year round in the Santa Ynez, but I change the variety in the season. And some are strong in the particular season, some are not. So when I introduce a new variety, I always go through the whole 1 year to a test because you cannot just judge that one season, this is a good variety or a bad variety. I have to go through the whole season to put into my production. It takes about 3 years to get into my full production. So,
Shu, were you a farmer in Japan?
No, I wasn't. And I went to ag school, but I never dreamed I'm, you know, a farmer. So.
And how did you get your first job here as a farmer?
So I landed here in L.A. in 1983. And so luckily, I found a farm in Camarillo in 3 days later. I got $150 a month. And I was bored. I have a place to live. I worked, 15 hours a day. I was so happy. And so $5 a day.
But you were happy.
Yeah, I'm happy. That all make a difference.
All right. And so, Shu, this is just amazing. Your lettuce and everything you do has just got such a beautiful look to it, and your staff seem to enjoy what they're doing as well. We can find you at the Wednesday Santa Monica, Sunday Hollywood. Where else can we get your lettuce?
And I do Santa Barbara Saturday and Tuesday, Santa Barbara and Solvang in Santa Ynez.
Well, it's lovely, and we're glad to have you here, and the little gems are delicious. If you haven't tried them yet, definitely give them a try. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
That was Farmer Shu Takakawa. He is an organic farmer from Los Olivos. He and his wife, Debbie, come to the Wednesday Farmers Market every week with varieties of lettuce and other greens and occasionally seasonal corn. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
That's it for this week's show. Go to kcrw.com or download our mobile app to listen to the show. You can also find our podcast and the first installment of a bonus podcast devoted to pie on iTunes. Funnily enough, it's called the Good Food Podcast. As always, many thanks to the Good Food team. Here they are.
Abby Fentress-Swanson.
Laurel Garcia.
Joseph Stone.
Hey, Abby, here's mine.
Camellia Say.
Pete Bloomberg.
Joel Stein.
Jackie Liu.
And Ronnie Mickelson.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and I will be back next week with more good food.